Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Leading Ideas Talks is also brought to you by Simply Christian, a video-based adult study featuring biblical scholar N.T. Wright. This 10-session study addresses questions of the reasonableness of the Christian faith in the modern world. Simply Christian is an excellent study for believers and seekers alike. Learn more at churchleadership.com/studies. How can you teach the New Testament in ways that make it come alive to modern people? In this episode, we speak with New Testament professor Shively Smith about innovative approaches to teaching the gospel that disrupt our staid and familiar notions of the biblical text.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I am Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center and your host for this talk. Joining me is the Reverend Dr. Shively T.J. Smith, Assistant Professor of New Testament at Boston University School of Theology. Our focus for this podcast is teaching the New Testament. Shively, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been looking forward to this conversation because so many people and congregations, pastors and other leaders really love teaching the New Testament, but sometimes struggle. So I just want to start off by asking you, what are some challenges that church leaders face in teaching Bible to modern audiences?
I think one of the first challenges, that's a really great question. I think one of the challenges that we have is, I would say, honoring the social and historical distance that we actually have from the New Testament, that we have when we're teaching, preaching, engaging the New Testament, especially in our congregations. Because, I mean, in some levels, there's a real sense of familiarity. We know what the Bible says. We know what the New Testament says. We know what Jesus said, what Paul said. But in fact, there should be a lot that we are actually puzzled by that feels unfamiliar or strange or even other to us about the text. And so I think it's really hard sometimes disrupting the tradition and the culture of familiarity with the New Testament in order to sort of make it come alive in new ways of our congregations.
Thank you for that answer. And I think that you're right. I remember one time doing a study, and it was actually sort of funny because in the text, it talks about wise men, but we, of course, always say there are three wise men.
That's right.
But the text doesn't actually say three wise men. But, I had people arguing up and down. But I said, no, read the text. And they were sort of floored that it actually did not say three wise men.
Right. I mean, so those are the things. We work with this sort of familiarity where we assume certain details because, you know, in some ways you get that because of the Christmas pageants, right? You're used to the babies, picking three of them to be the wise men, and then three of them get to be angels. I
mean, that's right.
We've collapsed the entire Christmas story into one, when in fact you've got, you know, these Matthew and Luke's versions are different and what's happening there. So that's a prime example of a place of being disruptive. Another place, if I could build off of it, where I see that is sort of the conversations about Pharisees and Sadducees and how we talk about Judaism as a single monolithic portrayal in the New Testament, and we miss that in fact we're talking about different forms of Judaism and commitments being practiced. And so in fact the Sadducees and the Pharisees are two groups that don't get along and actually don't see eye to eye on real matters of how Judaism is practiced. And then all of a sudden you hear about them in Matthew where they're going out to visit John the Baptist. So you have the Pharisees and the Sadducees going out together to see what John the Baptist is out there in the wilderness saying. We actually should be very shocked by that.
Wow, that's interesting. You're right. I don't think people often consider that that should be shocking. We just see it as natural that they would go together because we see both of them as antagonists to Jesus.
Exactly. And not recognizing that, in fact, they are, before they're antagonists to Jesus or John the Baptist, they're antagonists with one another. And so this sort of the speed of consensus that you see playing out actually should cause pause and question and open up an opportunity for, I would say, leaders to help the church, help to lead churches through what it means to engage in conflict management. Like, there's real opportunities when we slow down to define, to identify our distance from that history, new ways of engaging the text in the life of the community.
Just to build on that a little bit, before we move on, can you share sort of an idea or thought with the listeners for how they can sort of distance themselves from the text a little bit? Because I think it's so easy for us to read in our own lives, our own context, just naturally. So is there a way we can read it where we say, well, wait a minute, I should be thinking about this differently?
Yeah, that's a really good question. One of the ways that I invite people that I engage in the local text to do this is to just go back to the basics of primary school. Who, what, when, where, why? So instead of immediately assuming, so let's stick with our Matthew 3, the Sadducees and the Pharisees and John the Baptist, instead of immediately assuming that we know these, that we know these figures, we know what they're about, what does it mean to pause and say, now, who are the Sadducees? Who are the Pharisees? What do they believe? Why do they believe it? Do they believe the same thing? Where did they come from? What period are we talking about? We're not talking about the 21st century. We're talking about 2000 years ago in a completely different geographical locale. So I say one of the ways to do that is to go back to just those basic primary school questions and force ourselves to really answer them historically. Related to this is I always say there's nothing like a good old fashioned map. it can seem very low hanging fruit, very primary, but it can be actually very essential to look at the map and realize we are not talking about the United States or North America. I mean, that the names are different. The geography and topography that we're actually talking about is different. That's a way to sort of force us to reckon with, no, this is different. This is a different world. The visual of this world is different that they're talking about. We're even in a different locale.
That's very helpful. And that sort of sets up our next question. Can you share some of the more innovative approaches to teaching scripture that you use or you've seen others use? And you've just shared, I think, a couple of ideas. Are there some others that can be used to be more innovative as you engage the text?
So, the who, what, when, where, why, the map. I would also say I do a lot of work putting the biblical text in conversation with media, particularly sort of movies and images that are contemporary, that are familiar to us, and then images that are unfamiliar to us. I mean, I'll use archaeology, I'll use from, of these sites and of these places, and then use film to sort of get us to talk about different ways in which, the way in which I would say the religious rhetoric and conversation that's occurring in the New Testament may or may not match up with the values we're actually connecting with when we're watching something as fun as movies. Like, what are the assumptions that you grant when you're watching movies that actually sort of reflect what you think about? If we talk about, I like to do a lot of work around calling. So when you talk about calling and vocation, that may or may not actually be articulated in the biblical text. So I use that media to, again, other the text in some ways, bring it close, and then distance it at the same time, and then get congregations talking about sort of the different kinds of assumptions or even mental pictures and understandings that they're working with that actually may be rivaling each other. So they have one particular way that they are talking about what it means to be called people of God, a called community, a koinonia, a fellowship of believers when they're talking about the Bible. But it actually looks something, it looks totally different when you have them to engage that in conversation with something like the Beloved movie and Baby Suggs' moment, where she's doing this sort of ring shout and calling the community together. They may be related, and then they also may be distinct.
That's helpful. I mean, I think, and it allows for engaging the text in a different way that I think often many congregations don't take advantage of sort of the media to do so.
That's right.
So I know this is going to be a very challenging question for you, but what is your favorite passage to teach in the New Testament and why?
It is a very challenging question. I have quite a few.
I knew you would, but that's why I said, let's see if you can narrow it down.
Okay. One of my go-tos is probably Acts 15. And so Acts 15 is the Great Jerusalem Council. And so this is where you get all the players, all the who's who. So you have Peter and Paul and James. You have Messianic Pharisees that believe in this Messianic claim, that are a part of the community. And they're all trying to figure out, answer the a very fundamental basic question, which is, do you have to become Jewish in order to be a believer, to be considered followers of the way? And so I love that chapter because it has all of the who's who. It allows us to really push against this larger history and the possibilities of sort of anti-Semitic pieces, to really recognize that in fact, the followers of the way, the believers, are Jewish themselves. And so what the question of including non-Jews into the community starts with the question of proximity, relationship, embodiment of Judaism. I love it because it sets us up to think about the other text in the New Testament. I mean, you have Paul, then you get to think about the letters of Paul, you get to think about James, John. I mean, it's just, that is the chapter where everyone is in the room together, even the Spirit of God is in that space. And you can go any number of places in discussions and explorations about the biblical text.
That's one of my favorite texts also. And in fact, it's funny, I was just doing an event where I used that particular text. I'm curious, as you work with the text, and I'm sure you've done it several times, what is it that you are hoping people will walk away with as you approach the text? Or do you have, depending on sort of how you're setting it up, do you have sort of a different sort of insight you're hoping individuals will take away?
Mm-hmm. Specifically when I'm approaching Acts 15, is that?
Yes, yeah, mm-hmm. Acts 15.
Yeah, I think one of the big takeaways for me is to be a bit disruptive with with some of these simplistic narratives of Christianity and how it started. So to really use that as a space to talk about who do you see and what did you know about them before, and and what do you notice in terms of how they are portrayed, what they're doing in this text. So in some ways it's to sort of help to begin to nuance and make more complex this story of early Christianity. It also is to strike a certain degree of curiosity. People tend to see very quickly Paul and Peter in that. They miss Pharisees, or they'll see the Pharisees in the group and then they're confused by why they are there, right? Mm-hmm. Or they may miss that the real decision maker, in fact, is not Paul or Peter in that space, right? That you actually end up seeing that the person who makes the final decision, it actually isn't even decision by committee. One person makes the decision and owns that decision, and that's James.
That's
so
James, that's right.
Right, so how does that change our understanding of, you know, who are the leaders at the time at this part of the story. I also think it's helpful to engage in conversation, interfaith conversations, particularly with Christianity and Judaism, and then to open it up. All of those are big takeaways for me, big opportunities with this passage.
Yeah. I want to move and stick with the Bible, but move to what part does preaching play in teaching the Bible more effectively? Many of our listeners may not know this, but some will, is that you're also a fantastic preacher. So, you know, what part does preaching play in sort of being able to teach the Bible more effectively?
Yeah, I think that preaching, one of the things that I think is a real opportunity with preaching is I think that preaching can move people by sparking curiosity. So how do we preach in a way that ignites in people a curiosity to go back and revisit a biblical passage and to see it from a different angle? And when I say different angle, I actually am very much committed to see different people, different experiences with this passage in a real way. So I see preaching in many ways as a different rhetorical moment, but yet with the same goal that I'm trying to achieve in class, which is less about the banking system, depositing into students more information, more about getting them curious to go and explore and ask more questions, to be courageous enough to ask more questions of our biblical text, of our interpretive products, and of our faith and of ourselves. To me, that is the embodiment of what preaching can and should be doing right now, particularly as we are turning to the scriptures and resourcing it as a way to have conversations that our communities need.
I really appreciate that answer, because I think that too often we do the banking model, as you call it, and where we want to deposit with people something that they can take away. And not that takeaways are bad, but we really need to be careful that we're not simply depositing in such a way that we're creating lazy congregants, that we really want them to be active and curious about what is taking place and wanting to then, as you say, go and engage more themselves. Because I think often what happens, people just show up Sunday after Sunday just waiting for a deposit, and that's the end of what takes place.
Yeah, and I think that one of the ways we do that is to think about the preaching moment as not just a moment of declaration, but a moment of questions. Again, what does it mean to pose questions, and not just a single answer, but any range of possibilities for our communities to consider? The other piece I would really want to think about is what is the conversation between the preaching moment that we're having and, say, for instance, our Bible studies and biblical engagement. I think that there's real opportunities to put the two into conversation with each other. Now, as preachers, that requires a little bit of courage.
That's right.
And humility.
Yes, yes.
Because, you know, once you preach, you may be a little bit reticent to now invite people into talking with you about what they heard, what was clear, what was unclear.
That's right.
But there is a way in which to make the preaching moment isn't just our moment as preachers. This is really the congregation's moment to hear the proclamation and then to engage it and to allow it to make a demand on us to think differently, to grow in our faith commitments in our community. And so that happens, I think, best when preaching and the curiosity raising that we're doing in that moment is complemented by actually sitting together and opening the text up to see what we really do see, to see what we really do see there.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. The other challenge I think that many congregations face is with young people. So when they do have young people, oftentimes, the tendency is to dumb down the text or try to dumb down a text. How do you think we should engage youth in teaching the biblical text?
I think the question is, what do you see? It's just it's a very basic pedagogical question that I use all the time at all levels. And so even at that level, what does it mean to invite them to open the text up and to ask them, what do you see? What words do you see? What people do you see? What actions do you see? What do you see that makes you curious or bothers you? What do you see that is unfamiliar to you or familiar to you? And you could start with the biblical text, or you could start with the world. What do you see in your classroom right now that excites you or that bothers you, that looks like what we believe or challenges what we believe? I think that one of the biggest things that we have to do as leaders of the church, looking at resourcing the biblical text for these conversations, is to start with the site of the young adults rather than our site. And then to model for them what it means to put what they're seeing in conversation with our scripture, with our text, that we say are authoritative because they have resources for us to measure what we believe and what we do, and to reconsider it that way.
I want to move to sort of connecting to one of your favorite people, Howard Thurman.
Yeah.
And as you know, Thurman, because of his grandmother, was not a fan of the Pauline letters because of the reference to slaves and masters. The same could be true of gender and talking about women, stay in your place. And, these texts that people have interpreted in particular ways, but certainly still can be very challenging texts. How do you suggest leaders sort of teach and deal with some of these challenging texts in a way that you don't ignore them because they're there, but also hopefully is helpful?
Yeah, I actually, you just said one of my first points, which would be you don't ignore them because they are there. To probably nuance that a bit more, I would also say you don't ignore the real interpretive histories of these texts. So these texts aren't just written, are not just sitting in the New Testament static. They have had impact, they have had voice, they have had effect on communities, on bodies, on histories in a real way. And so I think one of the ways that leaders engage that is to name those interpretive histories and those problems, those difficulties, those conflicts that are there. And then actually, I am opposed to the idea of trying to then explain it away. I mean, I really think that there's something powerful about saying, hey, these texts have been used to bring life, and they've been weaponized to take life. They've been used to affirm the humanity of some while denouncing the humanity of others. And what does it mean to use that interpretive history as an invitation to help people get a better sense of our history? I mean, that's part of it. I mean, there's this growing, all the research talks about the growing the degree of biblical illiteracy in our congregations, but I always like to say there's also a huge degree of we are illiterate about our own histories.
Yeah, that's true.
And so there's a way in which it's not just raising an awareness and a sense of these different interpretive moments, but also these larger histories that are really important. The other piece is I am with Thurman's grandmother on this. I think there's a way in which the congregation, we can invite the congregation to make assessments of whether these are the places, some of these texts, as Phyllis Tribble calls some of them texts of terror. I mean, are these texts that we in this congregation want to lift up and want or do, or are there other places we want to go to think about our work as made in the image of God? And so for the pastor to not make those decisions, for the pastor to lead the communities through reflection and awareness raising and expanding our understanding of our history so that the congregation and the communities together can articulate where are the texts that they see as foundational and important for engaging these matters in society, race, class, gender, xenophobia, you name it, that we want to lift up.
And I think that is very helpful because I do believe oftentimes it's easy to ignore those texts and not really to engage them and engage them authentically. Mm-hmm. What tips would you have for a leader trying to write their own Bible study?
I will go back to what do you see? When you're working with a Bible study, I actually would say it's not a singular you, it's a plural second person, the second person plural you. So my Kentucky self will come out here, y'all. <It's> like, so what do y'all see? It's a way of recognizing that all these texts in the New Testament were written from and in service to a communal hearing, a communal reading, a communal reckoning in some ways is what I like to talk about. Not just to be interpreted, but they are written with a sense of not individuals, but entire believing community. So I think Bible studies need to start not with the individual pastor, but the community as a whole. What is it the community is struggling with? What are they curious about? And what does it mean to start with the community identifying what it is they want to do, what it is that they want to happen in their Bible study? We lead from there. The other piece is I actually think, what does it mean to shift your role as Bible study writer and leader to one of facilitator? So you are just facilitating conversations around the biblical text and the experiences of the community. You're not, banking and just coming and giving them 5 points that they have to write down and take notes for because they're trying to capture what you said. No. What does it mean to use the Bible study to lead the community through a process of scriptural discernment and communal discernment and talking? I think that those are real goals for any Bible study that you're working with.
And finally, as we get ready to bring this to a close, I want to ask, are there any resources that you think would be helpful for leaders and congregations to make use of as they are teaching the Bible in general or even thinking about creating their own studies?
So in terms of online resources, we're talking at the level of sort of like online resources and things that they can get their hands on easily, correct?
That's correct, yes.
I would say I think Working Preacher is probably one of the most robust resources right now that's constantly engaging thought leaders, congregational leaders, and thinking about the text. That's the resource. I think Bible Odyssey is another resource online that's available through Society of Biblical Literature. I'll tell you, I really enjoy the Westminster John Knox series, the Connections Commentary series and the Feasting on the Gospels and Feasting on the Word series. There you get 4 different points of view on these passages. They sort of get laid out and you get to hear different people engaging texts differently, which for me opens us up to recognizing there are so many different ways to think about and to come at even one text.
Well, thank you very much. I believe this has been extremely helpful for our listeners. And I know I've enjoyed the conversation. So great appreciation for your taking the time to do this.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope all is well.
On the next Leading Ideas Talks, we speak with Dave Ferguson about becoming a hero maker by focusing on making those around you great leaders.
So, can you define for our listeners what you mean by a hero maker approach to leadership or discipleship?
I think that the idea around a hero maker is that the focus is for a particular leader not just to be a great leader. Okay, because I think mostly people who are leaders, they want to do a good job, they want to serve well, they want to steward their talents in the right direction. But there's a tweak here, and it's really significant, is instead that they want to make the leaders around them great. So rather than just trying to be a great leader, you want to make the leaders around you great. I think that's one of the biggest differences.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.